You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This episode is something that originally aired on a YouTube channel we do. If you'd like to get the latest videos before they come to the podcast form, please do consider heading over to YouTube and just plug in Biographics, spelt the same way that this podcast's name is spelt, and you will see all of our videos. They were designed for video first, but we just wanted to make them accessible to people in the podcast format. So please consider doing that. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review, a rating, wherever you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. It really does help us out. It gets this in front of more people, which is always a good thing. It really keeps us making it. I like reading the reviews. So there's that. And let's get into today's episode.
Just before we get started, I do want to say that there's going to be a lot of French pronunciations in this one. Indeed, the character of this video is Joan of Arc. I'm going with the accepted English pronunciation of her name. If you want to have a go at me in the comments, you can. She's one of history's youngest warriors. At an age when most of us were stressing out about what to wear to school, Joan of Arc was leading thousands of French troops into battle against the English. Supposedly inspired by divine visions of Catholicism's greatest saints, Joan first took up her sword at age 16, she was leading armies by 17, and she was burned at the stake before she was even 20. In her short life, she managed to change the course of the Hundred Years' War, ending English domination of France. Certainly not bad for an illiterate girl from the sticks. But while most of us know the name Joan of Arc and know her tragic end, how much do we actually know about her life? Well, join us today as we take a look at the simple peasant girl who changed European history before dying alone and disgraced, convinced that she was a failure. We don't know today the exact date of Joan's birth. All we know is that it was sometime in 1412 to a farming family of some means. Now, some means here is definitely a relative term. Joan's village of Domremy in northeastern France was shockingly poor. Still, her father, Jean, managed to scrape together 50 acres of farmland, and the family lived in the biggest house in the town. For young Joan, life in Domremy meant a life of sowing and taking care of animals. As a girl in medieval Europe, no one taught her to read and write or do other manly things. They did teach her how to pray, though. Joan's mother, Isabel Romy, was a devout Catholic. And how devout was she? Well, there's evidence Isabel may have made a pilgrimage to Rome earlier in life, a crazy feat for a woman living at a time when traveling three villages over meant a day's riding and the knowledge that you might be killed by bandits. But Isabel lived in a time when public devotion afforded a woman a certain level of respect that was not found elsewhere. Early 15th century France was filled with female visionaries who, it was taken as fact, could communicate with God. While Isabel herself never claimed to be a mystic, she likely told young Joan all about these women. Still, Joan's early life was relatively uneventful. She became a master seamstress, she worked on her dad's farm, she made a handful of friends. Had she been born at a different time, it's doubtful we'd be talking about her at all. Heck, it's doubtful those in Domremy would have even remembered her. But Joan wasn't born at any time. She was born in 1412 in northern France. And northern France in 1412 was a place in the grip of a destructive conflict. Joan of Arc had been born slap bang in the middle of the Hundred Years' War. The Hundred Years' War could win awards for the least accurately named historical event. In fact, it was a series of wars between England and France, and it lasted 116 years, not 100. Now, normally what we'd do is we'd mention the Hundred Years' War and we'd just move on, but Joan of Arc's life was so short and so tied up in the Hundred Years' War that we'd have to keep halting the narrative every 2 seconds just to stop you from going, "What's going on, Simon?" So, like a fun Pixar short, here is our quick biography of the 100 Years' War that was not 100 years and wasn't really a single war. So, 1066, the Norman king, William the Conqueror, earns his nickname by conquering England. Crucially, he retained his claim on the French throne, as did his descendants. Nearly 300 years later, in 1328, King Charles IV of France, he dies. This was super good news for William's descendant, Edward III, who was next in line for the throne. So at this point, you're probably thinking, well, good news, Edward gets two countries, right? Well, no. Instead, the French crown's local noble, Philip VI, all while blowing raspberries across the Channel at England. Fed up with all of these Frenchies taunting in his general direction, Edward went to war with France in 1337. By 1360, everyone was tired of warring, and Edward accepted a chunk of northern France in return for abandoning his claims to the throne. So the warring stopped until 1380, when the French crown's crazy Charles VI, a guy who genuinely believed that he was made of glass. Charles VI was so incapable of ruling that he created a power vacuum. In 1407, the French houses of Orléans and Burgundy actually went to war to fill it. The House of Burgundy, by the way, that's a name you're going to want to remember. So, a year after Joan was born, in 1413, Henry V was crowned King of England. Desperate to revive his claim to the French throne, Henry demanded to marry one of Charles VI's daughters. The French, in response to that, were pretty much like, nuh-uh, that's not happening. And England and France, they went to war yet again. But this time, the House of Burgundy allied with the English. This led to the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, when the English and Burgundians not only booted the French up their backsides, but made off with their pantaloons too. The treaty was humiliating for France. Alongside other stuff, it set things up so Henry would inherit the French throne when Charles died. But then Henry made the mistake of dying just before Charles also died, technically making Henry's 10-month-old son, Henry VI, king of both nations. The French decided that being ruled by a baby was just a bit ridiculous, so they made Charles of Valois king instead. And yes, we return to that old classic French play of screw the treaty and blow raspberries across the Channel. Only the English, they were no longer across the Channel, but they were occupying the north of France. That included not only Paris, but also Reims, a city where Charles of Valois had to be crowned to be recognized as king. So that's where things were by 1425. The English and the Burgundians had everything above the Loire River, while Charles of Valois stewed to the south, unable to become king until he made it to Reims. It would take a miracle to break this deadlock and end this near century of conflict. Luckily, though, miracles were what Joan of Arc was all about. Just as Charles of Valois was sulking around, wishing he could be king, young Joan of Arc was having an extremely spooky experience. Now aged 13, Joan's life in Domremy was much the same as it was when we last left her. But there was one major difference. As she reached puberty, Joan started having visions of St. Catherine, St. Margaret of Antioch, and St. Michael. Now, at first, these visions, they simply told her to lead a pious life and remain a virgin. But as time passed, they started telling her, you know, actually, how about you become a warrior and you put Charles of Valois on the throne? That sounds pretty good, right? Now, as I said earlier, female visionaries, they weren't uncommon in France, but that doesn't mean that people took them seriously. The other kids, they certainly laughed at Joan's visions. But the visions, they persisted, until one day in May of 1428, when Joan was 16, the saint suddenly told her to go to see Charles in Chinon. Now, this was a bit of a problem. The war had left steadfastly pro-Charles Domremy completely surrounded by hostile Burgundian territory. With Chinon around 500 kilometers away, any journey Joan undertook on her own would likely have ended up with her dead. So Joan didn't even try. Instead, she went to the nearby pro-Charles stronghold of Vaucouleurs. There she found the garrison commander, Robert de Baricourt, and she demanded that he send her to the rightful king. Robert de Baricourt responded by throwing her out on her ear. We're not joking here, he actually told Joan to make sure that her father gave her a good beating. Spurned, Joan went back to Domremy, presumably muttering obscenities. The rest of 1428 it passed rather slowly. In Domremy, Joan's father tried to marry her off, only for Joan to successfully argue in court that she'd taken a vow of chastity and must remain single. Throughout the proceedings, Joan kept on talking about her visions to the point that the news began to seep out to other villagers. There were even stirrings that she might be the virgin prophesied to lead France to victory over England. Eventually, the rumors they reached the Burgundian forces. They responded by sacking Joan's village. Now, remember here, the House of Burgundy, it was allied with England. The last thing they wanted was some prophetess saying Charles of Valois should be the king. If the sacking was meant to be a warning, though, it had the opposite effect. In January of 1429, Joan returned to Vaucouleurs. As she rode there, word of her visions spread. By the time she reached Robert de Baudricourt, she was a minor celebrity, and Baudricourt noticed. When Joan repeated her demand to see Charles, Baudricourt unexpectedly agreed. He gave Joan six armed men as an escort and pointed her in the direction of Chinon. And just like that, Joan of Arc was off to see the king. Now, I guess you're probably wondering right now, well, why did Baudricourt change his mind? Some think it was just to get this pushy peasant off his back. Others think, though, that he'd taken note of the Burgundians sacking Joan's village and realized there must be something to her. But there is a more likely explanation. By early 1429, the French, they were desperate. The news of the war coming in could not be worse. The English and the Burgundians were running riot in the north while French forces were bankrupt and low on morale. Worse, back in October of 1428, the English had laid siege to the vital town of Orléans. Word was, Orléans was about to fall. When it did, the game, it would be over for the French. All of this may be why, on February the 13th, 1429, Joan and her guard of six men were allowed to ride out of Vaucouleurs and into the unknown. We really can't stress just how dangerous this was. Joan was a girl riding into lawless territory. It doesn't take much to imagine what certain men might have done to her. Thankfully, Joan realized this. Before setting off, she cut her hair short and began dressing in men's clothes. There's evidence that it was more than just a disguise. During her ride to Chinon, Joan adopted the habits of the six men that she was with. She slept alongside them, she dressed with them, she acted like one of the boys. It's something she'd do while serving in Charles's army, and it's likely the key to the respect that her men had for her. 11 days after setting off, Joan and her entourage, they finally arrived at Chinon. The stories of what happened next, they're the stuff of legend. Charles refused to admit this strange girl for 2 days before finally testing her by hiding among his entourage and calling for her. The moment she entered the room, Joan, who couldn't possibly have seen him before, strode straight up to Charles and declared that she'd been charged by God to lift the siege on Orléans and make him king. It was an impressive display, and one probably matched in the private meeting that the two of them had, although we can't say for sure because no records of this survive. What we can say is that Charles emerged from the meeting ready to give Joan a chance. This was not only to go to Orléans, but also to put her case to the church authorities. The idea was to convince them that God was really working through her. Over the next 3 weeks, Joan fielded questions from a barrage of theologians. She answered with remarkable frankness. When asked to prove her abilities, she told them to send her to Orléans so that she could prove herself by lifting the siege. Eventually, the theologians must have figured it was a worthy shot because they told Charles to roll with it. In April of 1429, Charles agreed. It's a move that could have ended his crumbling regime. I mean, imagine the propaganda. Fake king sends deluded girl to die in battle. But dying at Orléans, it didn't even cross Joan's mind. She knew that God was on her side, and she was about to prove it. All the time Joan was trying to convince Charles to send her to Orléans, her legend was growing. We know this because the French army was so broke that Charles was relying on volunteers. But when he put out a call that basically said, hey, he wants to go with this crazy girl and die defending a random city, thousands of men, they actually responded. It was the first sign of the almost mystical loyalty that Joan was able to command. On April the 29th, 1429, Joan and her new army arrived at the siege of Orléans. Joan was riding atop a white horse, a Christian banner held high. With some quick diversionary work, they gained access to the city, expecting to be heralded as saviors. Instead, they found a city on the brink of collapse. Orléans was, at that time, under the control of a man literally called the Bastard of Orléans. While the title referred to his parentage, it could have been used in our modern sense. The bastard, he loathed Joan. He was gearing up to surrender and didn't need some jumped-up peasant telling him that God was going to save them. He locked Joan out of meetings and refused to give her any role. It was a move designed to get rid of her, but it was also a move that failed to recognize one important point. All of the new troops from Chinon were loyal to Joan, and the rank and file of Orléans, they were already turning to her side. On May the 4th, Joan was resting when she suddenly had another vision telling her to attack the English. She grabbed her sword and banner and raced out of the city to the east, just as the French were beginning an assault on a fort. The sight of God seemingly coming to their side rallied the French. As Joan plunged into the thick of the battle, they began to fight hard. The fort fell, then the next day, another, and another. By the time May the 7th dawned, the French had done the impossible, they'd broken the siege. All that remained was to make a last assault on the English, and Orléans would be saved. In the early hours, Joan led her army into battle again. By now, the English were aware of the spooky girl who made the French fight like lions. When the archers saw her raise a banner, they took aim. The arrow hit Joan in the shoulder, piercing 6 inches deep. It knocked her flat and left her in agony. She was dragged from the field for emergency surgery. Had God just abandoned the French? Not even close. That afternoon, despite suffering a wound that would leave most of us curled up on the floor wailing for our mums, Joan returned to the battlefield. The sight of her banner rising once more in the afternoon sunlight sent up a great cheer from the French. They routed the English. By May the 8th, England's forces, they were in full retreat. Joan of Arc had done exactly what she'd promised to do, and the Siege of Orléans, it was over. If you need proof of the kind of power Joan of Arc had over the people, look no further than what happened after the Siege of Orléans. With the English in flight, the French forces went to chase them, only to be told by Joan in no uncertain terms that it was a Sunday and good Catholics they didn't fight on a Sunday. Amazingly, these rough men, they listened to her. The English, they were allowed to escape. As they retreated, it's said that Joan went and wept over their dead, a sign of respect that would not be reciprocated at her trial. Not that there was much time for Joan to weep, though. She already had another task. She needed to get Charles to Reims. The problem was that Reims wasn't like Orléans, sitting on the front lines. It was deep into the English territory. She might as well be trying to take him to London. But Joan, she kept on pressing, and Charles was eventually like, "Fine, I'll go, but you're gonna have to clear a path for me first." And well, that's exactly what Joan did. Over the next few weeks, her army stormed up and down the Loire River, liberating towns. So effective was she that the English began to believe that she was possessed by the devil. Not that Joan was particularly satanic, she never personally fought, instead using her banner and bravery to inspire her men. She also absolutely forbid her forces from looting or to rape any women. The only unusual part from a medieval perspective was the way that she insisted on dressing with and sleeping alongside her men. It's because of this that modern historians have theorized that she may have been gay or trans. Finally, on June the 8th, Joan's forces met the remnants of the English at the Battle of Patay. To say Joan's army mopped the floor with them would be a disservice to mops. They absolutely pulverized them. After this, Charles, he couldn't ignore Joan any longer. When she came back and told him to get his kingly ass to Reims, he absolutely agreed. As Joan and Charles rode across northern France, town after town fell without even putting up a resistance. They liberated Auxerre, Châlons, Troyes. Troyes was the place where the French had had to sign the humiliating treaty with Henry V. On July the 16th, the royal army finally reached Reims. The gates opened as they approached. The City of Kings had fallen. Just 2 months ago, the idea of getting the French army to Reims was like asking Jar Jar Binks to single-handedly fight his way inside Darth Vader's private chambers.
Nope.
And now, here, Joan and Charles were triumphant. The very next day, July the 17th, 1429, Charles of Valois was coronated Charles the 7th of France. Joan stood beside him during the ceremony, and afterwards she knelt and called him her king. At that point, her visions, they just stopped. Her mission, it was over, and God apparently didn't have any more plans for her. But it seems Joan had gotten a taste for battle. As Charles the 7th embarked on a victory lap around his newly conquered territories, the Maid of Orléans made a fateful decision. She decided to go to Paris. On August the 28th, 1429, Charles the 7th opened peace negotiations with the Burgundians, who were suddenly not really so hot on their alliance with the losing English. The news gave Joan the bad feeling that any peace treaty might block her taking action against Paris. This was a big deal, as the French capital, it lay in the hands of the English. So Joan, she went rogue. On September the 8th, she led her army out independently to attack Paris. This was a major mistake. To continue our Star Wars metaphor, taking Paris in 1429 was like trying to break into the Death Star using an anchovy. The walls of the city, they were nearly 30 feet high. Still, Joan, she tried, waving her banner and demanding that Paris surrender. She got a crossbow through the leg for her trouble and was dragged from the battlefield, screaming at her men to continue the assault. Instead, they retreated. When word got back to Charles about what Joan was up to during his delicate negotiations, he cut her loose. Yep, Joan might have made him king, but Charles had no problem with stopping her supplies of weapons and men and then basically ignoring her. While he did allow her to keep fighting, it was probably just to keep her busy. That Joan riding around liberating the odd small town was a Joan not whipping up discontent in the army. Still, it wasn't until the spring of 1430 that it became clear just how far Charles was distancing himself from the girl who had saved his regime. During an attempt to relive a siege on Compiègne on May the 23rd, Joan was knocked from her horse behind enemy lines. Seeing no point in fighting on, she allowed herself to be captured by the Burgundian forces. Everyone expected Charles to quickly trade for her. Everyone they expected wrong. Charles just didn't lift a finger. This left the Burgundians in an awkward position. On the one hand, they wanted to keep Charles happy and sign a treaty with him, but on the other hand, they didn't want to just return his best leader to the field to take more Burgundian towns. So in July of 1430, they reached a compromise. They sold Joan to the English. When Joan heard the news, she attempted to commit suicide by leaping from the tower of a castle. But she survived, and on January 3, 1431, she was handed over to English loyalists in northern France. So what did the English and their stooges do when they got their grubby little paws on the girl who made Charles VII king? Well, they took her to Rouen, and they put her on trial. On March 25, 1431, the church authorities at Rouen charged Joan on 70 religious points, ranging from heresy to dressing in men's clothes. Weird as that last one seems, it was legit. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 5 does actually contain a direct prohibition from God on women wearing men's clothes. So, well, now you know. Joan's prosecutors, they set theological traps, trying to trip her up in doctrine. One of the key parts of the Joan of Arc myth is that she was able to avoid these traps and leave the prosecutors with almost nothing. Those original 70 charges, the authorities were forced to throw 58 of them out. But let's not kid ourselves that this was just a spirited debate about theology. From the moment she got to Rouen, Joan was kept in awful conditions. She was chained to a filthy bed in a filthy prison and given just enough food to keep her from dying. Day and night, male guards, they watched her, taunting her, and threatened her with assault. On April the 18th, Joan's conditions, they caused her to fall badly sick. Convinced she was dying, she begged to be allowed to see a priest. Her request, it was refused. Finally, on May the 24th, the authorities had had enough. Unable to settle the last 12 points, they dragged Joan outside for a mock execution and then basically said, "Sign this confession or that execution, next time it's gonna be real." Joan signed. The document contained a very specific clause forbidding her from ever dressing as a man again under pain of death. Something that this clause was inserted very deliberately because a couple of days later, the authorities came to visit Joan in prison and found her dressed as a boy. The official version is that Joan had claimed the saints had ordered her to wear the clothes, but other sources suggest the cause was far darker. Supposedly, the men guarding Joan stripped her naked and gave her the choice of either putting on male clothes or remaining naked before them. Knowing what would happen if she remained naked, Joan, she chose the clothes. Regardless, the outcome was the same. On May the 30th, 1431, Joan was led out to Place de Vieux Marche and tied to a stake. It's said that one of her guards slipped her a wooden crucifix on the way in order to comfort her. That warm spring day, Joan of Arc was burned alive. The executioner was forbidden from easing her misery by killing her before the flames reached her flesh, and Joan died screaming in agony. Her reported last words were the pitiful wailing of a teenager begging for St. Michael to rescue her. The angel never appeared. When the execution was over, the authorities had her remains burned again and then scattered her ashes in the river. The story of Joan of Arc, it was over. Or was it? 19 years after Joan was executed, Charles VII rode in Rouen. By now, the Hundred Years' War was winding down and the French were on the verge of winning. Stood in the city where his one-time savior burned to death, Charles ordered an inquiry into Joan's trial. This inquiry ended up at the Vatican, where in 1456, Pope Calixtus III annulled all charges against her. When the news reached France, Joan was elevated to a martyr. The 116 years of conflict had finally ended in 1493, and war-shattered France was in need of a national hero. And in Joan, they found one. She's kind of remained there ever since. On May the 16th, 1920, Pope Benedict XV canonized her. 4 days later, the French Parliament declared a national day in her honor. Fast forward to today, and she's arguably more famous than Charles VII, Henry V, or any of the forgotten kings who fought and raged around her. But there's more to Joan's legacy than just being remembered. You can still see the effect that she had on the entire world. Historians think it's unlikely that Charles VII would have won the Hundred Years' War without Joan. That means an English victory, which, as great as that sounds, would have meant no united French nation. Just think, no France means no French Revolution, which means no Napoleon, which essentially means no modern world. Just to pick at random, there would be no metric system, no Louisiana Purchase, no France to back the Americans in the Revolutionary Wars. The entire planet, it would look completely different. Was Joan of Arc divinely inspired, or just a deluded peasant girl whose belief was enough to make her a warrior? It really doesn't matter. In her short 19 years on Earth, Joan of Arc changed the world in ways that even kings and emperors rarely do. She may have been born a nobody, but she died St. Joan of Arc, the heroine of France.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.